Hello there, and welcome back to Peace in Their Time, episode 175, A Drunk in a Department. I've been spending the past month and a half effectively table setting, but now I feel like we're all set to finally start burning through the real narrative of this miniseries. With the foundation of the New Deal established in the first 100 days, I'm now going to start talking about how this myriad of programs actually played out. And just in case you're wondering, I'm not entirely done introducing those kinds of programs, as later this season I'll get to the Second New Deal, and you'll have a new set of acronyms to learn about. For now, though, I have more than enough on my plate, so let's get going. Many of the programs I've introduced, like the CCC, were broadly popular and seen as worthwhile endeavors by most everybody, regardless of political inclination. Others, like the AAA on the farming front, aroused some controversy, but ultimately was seen as at least an attempt to address the dire state the nation was in. Then there was the National Recovery Association, or the NRA. I introduced that bureau last week at the very end of the episode because that's where I wanted to pick up today. It was, on paper, one of the New Deal's most ambitious and far-reaching agencies, as it sought to bring regulation into every American industry in order to dampen the self-destructive tendencies of capital. That meant unprecedented levels of government influence in how businesses ran themselves and what they owed their workers and the public. Now, just because I used the word unprecedented doesn't mean that it was successful. It wasn't, and in fact, the NRA was the first great failure of the New Deal. And unlike instances later on when the Supreme Court stepped in to deem certain reforms unconstitutional, the NRA's lack of success was all its own. Or rather, it was on account of its most notable boss, Hugh Johnson. I also introduced him last week. He was a former brigadier general with a talent for organization and logistics. He also ran his mouth like a man possessed by some kind of middle American demon, and constantly offered his opinion, especially when he really shouldn't have. FDR was more bemused than anything else, at least at first, by his public antics of decrying the establishment of the country, and his legitimate organizational talents were what the president had on his mind when he offered the job. Johnson's big problem, though, aside from his uncontrolled alcoholism, which was undoubtedly his biggest, was that he was not a subtle person. Oh, his confrontational approach was endearing to those above him and a public that didn't directly interact with him, but it was wearisome to be around. And worse, his lack of subtlety meant that he couldn't detect when somebody was getting one over on him. That was decidedly bad given his new role as regulator-in-chief. The NRA would be directly interacting with the nation's business class, men that might have been a greedy, self-serving bunch, but were intelligent. Or if they weren't intelligent, then employed men who were, that saw it to be in their interest to advance the cause of their bosses. This meant that when it came time to start negotiating some change to an industry, like, let's say, workers' compensation or quality control of a certain product, Johnson would usually unload on his audience and attempt to browbeat them into submission. Initially, this was effective, but once people started dealing with him, they realized they could basically wait him out. Absorb the initial tirade denouncing their greed, then calmly tell him that they would be perfectly happy to work with him to address his concerns, but then drag out the conversation till the business side of the table got what it wanted. Johnson would usually start a meeting full of fire, but grow to accept counterarguments presented to him, especially if they were framed as minor tweaks here or there to the point he was advancing. This should not be totally surprising. As much as Johnson raged against the greed that had brought the nation to its knees, he was not himself much of a radical. After exiting the army after World War I, he had gone into the private sector business world under the auspices of his mentor, Bernard Baruch, whom he had become acquainted during the war, and is really someone I should talk about before I go any further. Baruch had served as chairman of the War Industries Board, a temporary agency to streamline logistics between the military and civilian vendors. Before that, he had been a stockbroker extraordinaire, one of a handful of men to earn the sobriquet Wolf of Wall Street. And after the war, he returned to that life. Reportedly, he was among the few who correctly foresaw the crash coming at the end of the 1920s, but there is some dispute on that. He certainly told people about the danger, and afterwards, people assumed he had saved his billions, but he himself made hints that he might not have sold everything quite in time, and that his public displays hid a much more modest reality afterwards. If Baruch was hiding significant financial losses, then it was smart of him to do so because he was in high demand as an advisor and was sought out by FDR for this purpose, much like Felix Frankfurter. Which is to say, he had too big of a profile to add directly to the team, but as somebody who'd been around forever and was well-connected, could not be discounted as an ally. Well, that and the fact Baruch could throw around some money, too. Baruch, though, was still very much a businessman, and his support of FDR stemmed from understanding the ability of government power to enrich the business world, but he was not in it to fundamentally reform the country. Though he wasn't put off by the waves of reforms, he was definitely pragmatic and didn't do anything to cause Roosevelt to put distance between each other, which might have also been due to him perceiving that he might have been on a little bit of thin ice with the president early on in their relationship. Baruch had initially backed Al Smith and Jacob Raskob in their bid to block FDR's nomination, and Roosevelt was the type to, well, never forget those kinds of things. That being said, Baruch quickly wormed his way close to FDR and was an active collaborator for the rest of the president's life. Part of that was because a couple of his protégés also got brought on board of FDR's team. George Peek, over on the AAA, provided a conservative counterweight to the progressive Tugwell and Wallace. Hugh Johnson was ostensibly supposed to be cut from a similar cloth. When Johnson left the army and went into the farm equipment business, Baruch helped him out getting started. In fact, it was George Peek whom Baruch partnered him up with in that enterprise. When a national crisis demanded people rise to the occasion, Baruch was there to make introductions. The general wanted to use government power to restructure the economy, which was fine enough for Baruch as he astutely understood the scale of the disaster, but Johnson wasn't entirely a progressive. He firmly believed in fiscal discipline and saw his role as much a moral one as a material one. So, what I'm saying is, he wasn't threatening to Baruch's worldview. And while FDR appreciated Johnson's candor while on the campaign and when the general served in an advisory role, as he transitioned to actually start running a part of the administration, that dynamic started to change. It didn't help that the brain trust of the administration didn't trust Johnson, seeing him as one of Baruch's cronies. Johnson, from the start, got on Roosevelt's nerves by making staffing appointments without running them through the White House. And it was probably a bad sign that none of the cabinets wanted overall responsibility for the NRA. Usually, they were all eager to claim some new patch of bureaucratic turf, but nobody wanted to deal with Johnson. What I'm getting at is that his list of allies was slim, with Labor Secretary Francis Perkins being the closest thing to a friend that he had. And even then, it was because she pitied him more than liked him. Ultimately, Roosevelt had to set up a committee of four cabinets and the FTC that Johnson would report to. Moreover, the Public Works campaign that was funded in the same National Industrial Recovery Act that created the NRA would be handled elsewhere. When FDR gave him that piece of news, Johnson visibly started to enter freakout mode. As an advisor, he had helped craft the NIRA legislation and wanted both the NRA and the Public Works campaign. Before Johnson could totally melt down, FDR simply ended the meeting. He had to take Perkins aside and ask her to guide Johnson out the side door away from the press. His complexion had turned purple, and Frances Perkins had to assure him as a means to calm him down that she had his back on the board of cabinet secretaries that he would be reporting to. And as it turned out, that board of cabinet secretaries that was designed to give Johnson and the NRA structure failed in its purpose, because all of those secretaries were more concerned with their own immediate work, and because each thought that reining in Johnson would be handled by a counterpart, so there was effectively no oversight. Which was bad, because some coaching was required with Hugh Johnson. The first big accomplishment, and I don't want to say win here as this was a very mixed bag of the NRA, was enforcing a new regulatory code onto the textile industry. Which might seem odd because the textile industry certainly didn't cause the Great Depression, but it was one of the biggest sources of employment, and was also one of the most exploitive. It was low pay, long hours, and child labor all the way down. The mills also, by and large, had migrated out of the larger cities in the North during the 1800s, and had reestablished themselves in small-town rural areas, especially in the Southeast. So it was basically places that were already impoverished. Moreover, the abuses of these companies were already well known, and if reform was going to happen, it might as well start there. The NRA implemented a new code mandating a 40-hour work week, a $10 weekly minimum wage, and banned child labor entirely. Slam dunk, right? Well, everybody thought so at the time it was implemented in July 1933. People cheered at the announcement. FDR heralded the end of a barbaric workplace legacy. There were some catches to that, though. One was that mill owners had already been winding down child labor beforehand. They were not surprised it was used as a cudgel against them, and in any case, they had come to prefer more productive adult employees. The wage hike became both a minimum and a maximum wage, one that the NRA was ill-equipped to enforce anyway. And when it came time to limit hours, management simply implemented production quotas, meaning that workers would have to make the same amount of goods, just in less time. They applied a concept called a stretch-out, where if you missed a certain output goal for a length of time, then your next goal would be increased to take into account the difference. If you fell behind, then you'd have to somehow be more efficient later. And if you fell behind too much, well, you were just out of a job. Finally, there was an especially brutal tactic of employers creating a learner category where these regulations would not apply. On paper, it was meant for people just getting started at a mill and was not intended to be an indefinite position. The trick was that employers would simply fire their entire staff, then rehire them under the entry-level category. And if they had to do it again, well, then they'd just do it again. Union leaders probably could have brought these kinds of things to Johnson's attention, but he didn't consult with them. While the NRA and the Roosevelt administration heralded the change as a great victory, the mill owners were able to present themselves as magnanimous and responsible partners, eager to work for the betterment of their workers and the country. Even though they weren't, and in fact were still the same soulless vampires they were before, and continued to act as such. This was kind of going to be how things went when Johnson encountered determined opposition to his reform efforts. Oh, and I'll get ahead of myself to preempt a question about legalities you might have. The implementation of these regulatory codes by the NRA was done without the passage of any new legislation. It simply used power contained in the NIRA and what already resided in the executive branch to issue sweeping changes. The Supreme Court is absolutely going to declare all this unconstitutional in 1935, so if you're wondering why other administrations don't do this kind of thing, it's because they're not allowed, and because they're kind of cowards. A thing to perhaps remember, though, was that this was the first assignment of its kind that Johnson was being assigned. As a general, he had done a lot of organizational work, but it was very structured in the Army. The system there was a set one with clear precedent. The NRA was not that. It was a brand new agency with a potentially broad mission statement, depending on how far you wanted to go. FDR was a president that didn't get wrapped up in the details, and certainly did not have any specific commands on how Johnson should approach running his new agency. At his discretion, he was to save capital from itself. And oh boy, did he ever start shooting from the hip. He must have felt terribly repressed in the Army, as he immediately embarked on a publicity campaign in July 1933 to publicly cajole employers into not only hiring on more people, but also to pay them good wages so as to get them consuming again. Warning against the perfidious nature of ill-defined cheats and slackers, he forced many businesses into at least a public show of compliance. If an enterprise was deemed to be properly compliant with the NRA's requirements, they were allowed to label their products with a Blue Eagle NRA logo with the words, "We do our part." The Blue Eagle became the first instance of New Deal branding, a thing that the public saw in store shelves as the government doing something about, well, everything that was happening. Johnson became an overnight celebrity, a public crusader who relished the fight. Time magazine named him Person of the Year in 1933, providing a break between 2 years in which FDR himself won the acclamation, so his work was not small potatoes. The thing is that sometimes the cliché of something burning bright and quickly is all too true, and that's exactly what happened to him. The entire Blue Eagle and public pressure campaigns were probably ill-advised in retrospect given the extreme youth of the NRA, because back in Washington, the agency was slammed. Once the textile codes had gone through, everybody and their mother started submitting ideas, and the young NRA was bogged down with reviewing proposals and tailoring the viable ones into something implementable. On July 21, 1933, he sent a mass telegram, which, yes, was basically a mass email in those days, to the heads of the chambers of commerce to every city with a population of over 10,000 people. The note wasn't anything specific, just that they should follow him as patriots wanting to rebuild the country. He addressed a crowd 26,000 strong in St. Louis, promising that any of the greedy business class that refused to comply with the NRA would be brought to ruin. Hugh Johnson's personal popularity probably peaked in September of 1933, when on the 12th and 13th, he arrived in New York City. On day one, he addressed a packed Madison Square Garden, and on the next day, he was the centerpiece of a leisurely 9.5-hour parade down Fifth Avenue before a million onlookers. His presence brought out a carnival atmosphere, appropriate given that his talent was as a carnival barker. The circus, though, didn't produce beneficial regulation. Time and time again, the NRA would score some concessions that sounded nice in a newspaper article, but retreated on pay and the ability of workers to organize. Johnson himself was no friend of labor, and more than once threatened that he would empower companies with the sole right to speak on their employees' behalf. And there was one businessman who declined to even humor Johnson's tirades, and that was, unsurprisingly, Henry Ford. Ford refused to abide by the NRA standards and dismissed the Blue Eagle as a Roosevelt buzzard. Johnson tried to retaliate by shutting Ford out of government contracts, but Ford responded by simply seizing more of the consumer market. It wouldn't matter anyway. The NRA, and Johnson in particular, were set to implode before the old man would feel any adverse effects. By the fall of 1933, people were starting to point out that the NRA was spilling a lot of ink, but not really delivering a lot to normal people. The new regulations were favoring established conglomerates, trampling smaller firms right out of business. They also opened the door to groups of large companies to start fixing prices, an open act of monopolistic behavior that alarmed a Congress already weary of Johnson's ignoring of the supervisory body meant to corral him. In January 1934, his enemies in Congress were bearing down on him, and he was forced to accept an independent inquiry. Johnson was offered the escape hatch of being able to suggest who would actually lead that inquiry, though. But in being able to select his own opposition, well, he screwed even that up. Johnson suggested a trial lawyer he didn't know, but had heard good things about. Well, that lawyer proved to be unsympathetic to the NRA, and the inquiry quickly made the accusation that the agency was facilitating monopolistic behavior directly. The saving grace was that when a formal report was made in May 1934, it warned that the NRA was going down the road of state planning of the economy and would lead to socialism. That went way too far, and the administration was able to then pounce on it to show that the inquiry had become tainted by partisan politics. Whatever the NRA was, it certainly was not socialist, and everybody could see that. Johnson responded to all the bad news with another PR stunt, this time announcing a 4-day town hall in Washington, inviting all and sundry to stop by and lay out their grievances with the agency's work. 2,000 people showed up on day one to call him out over the price-fixing schemes that the NRA had condoned. He pledged to revise the regulations to better serve the public, but time was already running out for him. As I mentioned a bit earlier, his big problem as a leader was that he was an alcoholic. And while I've covered a bunch of drunks on this podcast so far, he was the one in least control of his habit. He would vanish from the office around lunch and not come back so that he can go on a bender, which prohibition had only been repealed in full at the end of 1933, so there was a long stretch where he was obviously breaking at least some laws with his antics. His saving grace on that front was one Francis Robinson, the 26-year-old that he was having an affair with. I say saving grace because she worked as his secretary and might have actually done most of the work while he was too hammered to function. At least according to Perkins, who noted Johnson would have been out in short order had his lover not been there for him. When it came to knowing actual agency business, Johnson was hopeless and would direct questions to Robinson, who knew it all by heart. The issue that came into play was that she was always with him and always too closely for a secretary. People started talking, and naturally, Johnson's wife was an innocent old lady who people would not tolerate being wronged, especially so publicly. Then the salary info of the NRA came out, and it turned out she was the 4th highest paid employee on the agency's payroll. Reporters asked him about it, and he replied, "Well, that one is a little below the belt," to which the reporter started chuckling at his very poor choice of words. Perkins had to have a sit-down with Robinson and tell her to be more discreet, to which Robinson was understanding, as she was not blind to the situation. But Johnson, on the other hand, hated to be told what to do. The general's drinking, though, got worse as public criticism of the NRA mounted. Whereas before he could handle at least part of a day's work, well, that was dwindling fast. On several occasions, he just up and vanished for a week at a time. This finally bit him in the ass when Senator Robert Wagner of New York wanted to talk to him about a bill he was working on. He wanted to establish a labor relations board. Oh hey, where have I heard that one before? That would oversee and legitimize union elections and protect collective bargaining. It would be invaluable for the NRA to support the measure, but Wagner was also aware that Johnson was not labor's best friend and needed to come to some understanding with him. Johnson, though, was a ghost, incommunicado. Finally, one day, Perkins was able to locate him and had Donald Richburg, the NRA's formal second-in-command, escort him to her office where she and Wagner were waiting. The hope had been that he would be found before he was able to start day drinking, as the meeting was at 10 a.m. It was a dashed hope, as he reeked of liquor as soon as he walked through the door. Perkins tried to make the pitch all the same, then noticed him getting that dead, glassy-eyed look all of us have encountered at one time or another. The look of someone who was pretty much gone. Johnson got up, said that he had other duties to attend to, and said he would leave the decision to Richburg. Donald had his full confidence and would handle things. Whereupon, Robinson whisked him away and out of sight for the next 4 days. Perkins, Wagner, and Richburg handled the details and again had to hunt Johnson down. They presented the draft legislation, which kept the proposed review board outside the NRA. As soon as Johnson saw that, he exploded at them that he would never agree to such a thing. Wagner's attempt in 1934 to get the legislation through would fail, although he would try again with much more success in the next year. The incident caused a rupture between Johnson and Richburg, which had understandably been building the entire time they were working together. At first, things had been fine between them, affable even. Richburg was much more administratively oriented, but that proved to be a liability as Johnson got more and more out of control. The general grew paranoid over his obviously more capable subordinate, which was made worse as Richburg started getting more access to FDR himself. Richburg, too, started publicly sounding out that the agency had to consolidate its work, stop issuing new regulations, and instead fix the ones already on the books. He said that the NRA was still immature and developing, and that it had to move beyond that initial phase, a clear critique of his boss. And to be fair, he was exactly correct. In any case, Roosevelt was also thinking of moving on from Johnson. FDR was not the best person to fire anybody at the best of times. He took it too much as a personal failure to do that. After all, the appointment had been ultimately his. This would be the first great sacking of his administration, and he looked for ways to dress it up as a reshuffle. One idea was to conjure up some private sector offer that the general wouldn't be able to refuse. But Baruch was well aware of his former protege's self-destruction and refused to bring him back into his own fold. Walter Chrysler was approached about offering him a job, but steadfastly refused to deal with the man. Says a lot that guys who were eager for influence with the president that they'd flatly decline to do him a solid like that. Roosevelt and Perkins then came upon the idea of sending him to Europe on a kind of fact-finding tour to examine recovery attempts there. Roosevelt summoned Johnson to the White House to talk it over, and came away with the sense the general was willing to play ball. Perkins was overjoyed at the news. But then the next day, Johnson declined the deal. Roosevelt called him back in, talking to him for an hour and a half. This level of attentiveness was unusual for FDR, but Johnson really didn't take the hint over how delicate the president was being on his behalf. Whatever they discussed, Johnson emerged to meet the press immediately afterwards and said that the president told him that the administration needed him and the country needed him. He wasn't leaving. I don't think that's the conclusion their conversation actually came to, because Perkins and Richburg were both summoned to yet another meeting with Roosevelt and Johnson the next day. It was a 10 a.m. meeting, Johnson was the last to show, and yes, he was drunk. FDR told him directly to either go to Europe or resign. Johnson said he'd resign. FDR really wasn't good at just breaking off a relationship, though, and told him the next day, just take the Europe job. Johnson said no. FDR finally said that Johnson would remain in place, but actual management would go through Richburg, who would report directly to the White House. Johnson would be a powerless figurehead, but spared the public spectacle of a dismissal. FDR really should have just fired his ass, because while he was stripped of power, Johnson still had a public pedestal to speak from. In a fun coincidence, the United Textile Workers were striking in September 1934 to secure better conditions than the broken regulations instituted the year previously had called for. Johnson publicly spoke against the union, damaging the NRA's credibility. Then he also mentioned that he had been talking with Supreme Court Justice Brandeis about reducing the NRA's footprint and reducing constitutional questions that it had been raising. This brought Brandeis into the conversation, which was bad, because justices back then were very particular about how they engaged in public life. If he was seen as advising Johnson on questions about the NRA, then he would be obliged to recuse himself if something NRA-related reached the Supreme Court. Brandeis was a key vote on that body, so Johnson, in a moment of utter thoughtlessness, directly harmed the agenda of the administration. By then, the drinking problem was fully out of control and in the public eye, as the general was stumbling around town in broad daylight, drunk off his ass. On September 24, 1934, Johnson finally submitted his resignation, which FDR immediately accepted. A long, drunken storm had finally passed. The damage left behind was considerable. Even if the Supreme Court was not set to review the powers of the NRA, the agency had been badly discredited. Reform through regulation had taken a body blow it would never truly recover from during the New Deal. Oh, they'd go about it in a smarter fashion, but this was the closest the U.S. has ever come to having the economy managed by decree. The NRA was not long for the world, though. Under Richburg, the agency spent its remaining existence reorganizing into a much more low-key body in order to convince the Supreme Court that its work remained within constitutional bounds, which meant that Richburg would take an even more overtly pro-business stance, which aroused controversy at the time, but also didn't matter in the long run. The Supreme Court decided in May 1935 that the NRA as it was composed was unconstitutional, and the agency was dissolved, which I will cover in more detail later in the season when I get to the Supreme Court's relationship with the Roosevelt administration. The experience of the NRA was the first great disappointment of the New Deal, but there would be triumphs as well. Just not next week, as we'll be covering the haphazard experimentation of Roosevelt's early monetary policy and how it helped alienate the rest of the world and turn the business class against him. Join me then, and as always, thank you very much for listening.